lives. Well, it is great to see you out there this morning with us, and great that you chose to be here to worship this morning. There's just something about getting to worship together that just makes it feel right, doesn't it? So we're glad you guys were here. We are going to be in Luke chapter 14 today. We're starting a new little kind of mini sermon series over Luke chapter 14. But while you're turning there, I have a funny question to ask you. Dumbest question you've ever been asked. Does anyone like eating out? There's like four or five people that like eating out. There are a couple of people that are being honest and going, not so much. You know, maybe I should ask this. Who likes eating? Woo. Yeah. This is probably a bad series of questions to ask because now everyone's going, he's surprising us with lunch today. And I am not, so no lunch today. Sorry, Mark. Mark is buying. Mark's so disappointed. He's so discouraged. You know, because let's be honest, college students, their favorite word is free, right? Because you are broke and you hear free and you go, free, yes, free. We don't have anything free, but sorry. But I do think I was thinking this week as I was preparing just the sermon series over the last couple of days, I was thinking about how many things we do when you have lunch together or you have a supper together. I mean, think about it here for a minute. You know, if you've got we have high school graduation coming up. We've got college graduation. Howard Payne and R. Harden Simmons people that we have are all graduating this week, the ones that are graduating. A lot of times I remember after my graduation, Allison's family and my family got together and had a meal. We had reserved like 20-something seats at this restaurant, and we piled in there, and we had this meal together, right? Because we celebrate all that, right? Who actually went out to eat with someone on a first date? Right? Wow, like three of us, and a couple of people nodded their heads. You guys do know what dates are, right? We're clear on all that, right? All right, we go out to eat for dates. We have meals at weddings. We've got meals, even a more relaxing, I've seen meals happen for job interviews. You want to get someone in a relaxed setting, you have a job interview with them, and you'll sit around and have a lunch together or a supper together. Because it's about really getting to know someone, and you can kind of do that. You have a longer period of time, a relaxed atmosphere. Plus, we're Baptist. I think every church I've ever talked to, I've met with the team over a meal because we're Baptist. That's what we have to do, right? It's part of being Baptist. I remember when we did Tony Evans' study on Kingdom Men, when the men went through that study, he talked about the most important thing for the family to do is gather around the dinner table and have a meal together, right? That is the most important thing. Y'all, there's a lot of important things that happen around the dinner table, doesn't it? A lot of important things that happen in those moments. We celebrate, we work out vacations, we work out differences, we do a lot of things around that table. And you guys know what I did? I don't have my Bible here. Can I grab a Bible down there? Okay. The ironic part about all of that is that I actually marked my Bible right before the service started, and I guess I left it sitting on the counter of the office. So, y'all, it's one of those days. If anybody wants to take me out for a meal after this, that would... All right, so Luke chapter 14, we actually see this moment where Jesus is at a dinner. And there's some really important things, some really neat things that happen in this passage, and we're going to be looking at it over the next couple of weeks. But today we're going to be in Luke 14, we're going to be in verses 1 through 11. And the translation of our pew Bibles, which incidentally, since I grabbed one of those pew Bibles, it's a good chance to remind you, we haven't reminded you in a while, these Bibles are for you. These Bibles that are underneath your seats, you can take them home. You are allowed to steal from us if you want to consider that. You are encouraged to steal from us. If you know someone that needs a Bible, take them. We have an entire fund that we can buy new ones out of, and we do that. So we do want to remind you, if you're kind of like me and need a Bible, which apparently I did today, grab one. You can take it. You can keep it. You can give it to a neighbor. You can give it to a friend. You can do whatever you need to with it. So reading in Luke chapter 14, starting in verse 1, notice the day, okay, that Jesus is meeting with someone. What does verse 1 start with? One Sabbath, all right? This is important. This is a big deal. So let's look at this. Actually, I need to back up before we do all this. I want you to see where we're going to be headed as part of this meal. And that's verse 11. I want you to see what verse 11 actually says. And here's what verse 11 actually says. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. And he who humbles himself will be exalted. We'll put that up there on the screen. We want you to consider that is where we're going. So you have to read everything through the lens of that right there. So let's start in verse 1. One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and the Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? But they remained silent. Then he took him, and he healed him, and he sent him away. Then he said to them, which of you having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on a Sabbath day will not immediately pull him out? And they could not reply to these things. Now he told a parable to those who were invited, when he noticed how they chose the places of honor, saying to them, when you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do you not sit down in the place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him? And he who invited you both will come to you and say, give your place to this person. And then you will begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go to sit in the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you will be honored in the presence of all who sit at the table with you. And then this leads to verse 11. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. All right, so there's a couple of things that we're going to see just in the part we're looking at today, and there's two specific big events that happen here in this part that we just looked at. Okay, the first one is just simply this. There's the man that Jesus actually healed. Did you kind of catch that? All right, the translation that I read from here, the English Standard Version, actually says that the man has dropsy. How many of you heard that term and you have no idea what that term is? Right? All right, so let me tell you what dropsy is. Some of you, especially if you have someone in the medical field, you know the term edema, okay? I am not a medical person at all. But what dropsy is the same thing as edema. What it is it's a condition where parts of the person's body will actually swell. There's this excess accumulation of fluid, right? And then those things begin to swell because they have so much fluid in them. Are you with me on all that? When someone has dropsy, it's pretty obvious. Their legs are just bloated and swollen. You know, you can't even see their ankles because it's just, if they have dropsy in their legs, it just flows over all of that sort of thing. Dropsy is a symptom. Dropsy isn't the actual thing that's going on. Dropsy is just a symptom of that. Usually it's caused by other diseases. Usually there's a heart or a kidney or a liver problem that causes dropsy. And the swelling can be very, very painful, I understand. It can make moving difficult. It can make working difficult. And depending on what causes that underlying cause of it, it could actually even be fatal. You could lose your life because of whatever that underlying cause is. People that have dropsy, you can literally poke where it is, and it's going to take a while to even bounce back because of the way that it works. I mean, it's a pretty serious thing. So here you've got this picture, and incidentally, the Pharisees who have Jesus there, did you notice in verse 1 what they're actually doing? They are watching Jesus. What is it that they're concerned about? What Jesus is going to do. They invite him to dinner. They're trying to get to know him a little bit better probably, but more than that, they are watching him, and they are investigating him in a way. So there's this man with dropsy, and incidentally, they truly, I don't think, cared about this guy at all. All they cared about was how Jesus was going to respond to this guy. Right? Are you with me on all that? Because notice their response. Their response was, well, let's see if Jesus is going to heal this guy, because it's a Sabbath. It's a Sabbath day. Now, on the Sabbath day, you're not supposed to be doing any kind of work at all. Healing was considered work. So now, they're sitting around, and with the way that the timing works, they're sitting around having this lunch together. It's probably about 2 in the afternoon. Now the Hebrew days would go from evening to evening time. They didn't start at midnight. They would start like sundown time. So, consider this about 6 o'clock. Probably they're eating about 2 o'clock right here. Now, I love this fact, because Jesus could have told this guy, man, I know it's the Sabbath. Can you come back 4 hours? And let me do something about it. But he doesn't, right? What does Jesus do? He points out the fact that these Pharisees, the people that aren't concerned about this guy, they're just concerned about the way that they think it's supposed to be, that that is where their focus is. And they miss out on the chance to minister to this guy, because here's this guy that he is hurting, and they just ignore the suffering of this guy. They're more concerned with how Jesus is going to react. Okay, are you with me on all that? So notice what Jesus does. He heals the guy and then sends him on his way. Incidentally, I don't think this guy was invited to the party. They're having this really nice dinner party. I don't think this guy was invited. I don't think he was ever expected to be there. In part because they wouldn't be seen with a guy like that. And in part because you see in verse 7, Jesus says to those who were invited, do you catch how it was phrased there? So Jesus is now talking to those who are invited. So probably there's this gatecrasher who shows up. And Jesus, in his compassion, in the way that only Jesus can, his heart goes out to the guy, and he goes, I don't care if it's a Sabbath, I'm going to heal him. In the process, points out to the Pharisees, and he asks them, if your son or your ox falls into a hole on the Sabbath, will you get him out? And they don't have a good response. Do you know why? Because if they say yes, they've just shot their entire argument in their foot, right? I mean, they've just ruined that whole thing. Hey, thank you, Charlie. Charlie went and got my actual Bible. He's my hero. That guy. Do what? That's kind of awesome. Even though I'm probably not going to do a whole lot more reading from it. But we are going to be looking at the scripture. We're going to be dealing with all that. So notice here, we've got all this, which leads to the second big thing that we're seeing today that leads up to verse 11 that says, for everyone exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. And the second issue was this little parable that Jesus tells in verse 7, right? He says, now he told them this parable to those who were invited when he noticed how they would choose the best places for themselves. So imagine this. You can learn a lot about people over a meal, can't you? I remember a pastor one time told me, he said, in church work, you're going to be around a whole lot of people. If you want to see the heart of someone that you don't know real well, the very first thing you need to do is you need to go out and eat with them, and you need to see how they treat the waiter or the waitress. I thought, ooh, that's pretty good. I still follow that to this day. I think you can learn a lot about someone from the way they treat someone who's there to serve them, if you want to consider it in that terminology, right? So now, here you've got this, and Jesus tells the story. He was sitting there. He was one of the first people to arrive, apparently, and he saw them jockeying for a position, right? He saw them trying to sit in certain ways. You know, there's this attitude of, can I tell you what it's about? It's about pride. Truly, it is about pride. And there's a lot of problems with pride, because pride basically has this attitude that says, I am the center of my universe, right? So Jesus, he's here and he watches the Pharisees, and he's noticing that they're jockeying to have the best seats for the dinner. Now, it's still actually true, even today in the Middle East and in the Far East, that seating positions are a clearly defined part of the dinner protocol, right? Since there was a certain way that they would sit. You know, even in Asia today, you can see that the guest of honor sits to the right, then the next most important person sits to his left, and then it goes on, and everyone has a place, and everyone knows what their place is, right? The head of the table is a big deal in those cultures, and it was in Jesus' day. So what's going on here is these people are so prideful that they want the best position, right? Are you with me on all that? These people are so prideful that they want to ignore the need of someone who's right in front of them, because they want to focus on other things, the things they want to focus on, that they will ignore the needs of somebody sitting right in front of them. So we have the problem of pride here. And there's a couple of things we're going to talk about here, and I think the first thing is that it's hard to recognize that pride inside of you, right? Someone once said this great phrase it's always stuck with me. They said that pride is the only disease that makes everyone else sick except for the person who has it. All right, we'll put it up here on the screen. Can we put that up there, please? So there you go. Pride is the only disease that makes everyone else sick except the person who has it. Think about it. A prideful person is too busy pointing out everyone else's flaws, right? A prideful person is too busy going, oh, well, they have this problem, and they have this problem, and they have this problem, and then that's their problem, that's their problem, that's their problem. The pride is so hard to see inside yourself, but it's so easy to kind of see the faults in others, right? There's some great questions I think we can ask ourselves if we go, okay, am I a prideful person? How do we know if we've got pride? How is it that we know that pride is driving us in a lot of ways? One of those is if you like being the center of attention. Some people hate that, right? Can you be, that almost makes it sound like it's prideful to be an extrovert, but that's not necessarily the case, right? How much of, another question you could ask is, how much of my conversation is filled with the word I, right? As funny as it sounds too, I am a very stubborn person. Other people are stubborn people too, right? Stubbornness can sometimes be a form of pride, right? How about not liking to be corrected? That can be pride. That can be an example of pride in your life. The one that I kind of know, okay, how much is pride playing a part in me, in my life? This is a question I ask myself. How easily are my feelings hurt, right? Do you get impatient with other people's mistakes? Rather than show grace, it's impatience that kind of takes the wheel. Well, that's probably driven by pride. Seldom ask for help. You're just going to go do it yourself. You're not going to involve others. Do you get offended if you don't get thanked the way you should? Right? I guarantee you someone sitting here patting themselves on the back going, hey, I don't have any of that. All right. Right? Y'all, pride has such a hold in our lives sometimes and we don't even realize it because it is so, so hard to see. But I think it's also important that we remember that pride leads to ruin. That's one of the other problems of pride. It truly does lead to ruin. Pride never ends well. And it's ironic because pride says everything is just like I want it, but pride leads to a place where you don't really want to be. Pride leads to ruin. I love Proverbs 16:18 that says pride goes before destruction. That pride goes before a haughty spirit before a fall, right? Pride does not lead where we think it will. And this problem of pride long predates you and I sitting here today. We are not the first people to struggle with pride. And ironically, the first people to struggle with pride weren't even humans, right? The fall of Satan that you actually see in Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 15, here's what it actually said. It said, shining morning star, how you have fallen from the heavens. You destroyer of nations, you have been cut to the ground. You've said to yourself, now notice how many times Satan is going to say hi, say I. He says, I will ascend to the heavens. I will set up my throne before the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of God's assembly in the remotest part of the north. I will ascend above the highest clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. And then verse 15 of Isaiah 12 actually says that you're going to be brought down to the lowest pit. That's what's going to happen before. But this is what I think actually goes towards the very first sin as well, too. Because remember how Satan tempted Adam and Eve? Do you remember that in Genesis chapter 3? When Eve tells the serpent, tells Satan, look, we aren't allowed to eat that fruit because we'll eat it and we'll die. And the serpent tells her, is that really what God said? He says, no, you'll certainly not die. In fact, God knows that when you eat it, you're going to become like him and you will be just like God. What is that? Pride. That's saying, hey, I want to be the one that calls the shots. I know best. I know this. I can handle this. I can be that person. And Satan had fallen into that trap. And now he looks at God's, the apple of God's eye, God's most cherished thing in the world is people. And he goes, hey, God had to kick me out of his presence because of pride. Maybe if I can get them to buy into that, then he'll have to kick them out too. And the plan worked, right? Because notice it's all about, I want to be this guy. I want to be the one calling the shots. I want to be the one that gets to say what right and wrong is, which is the argument that Adam and Eve fell into. So I want you to think back to this dinner. You've got the Pharisees here that have been about trying to make themselves look good. They want the seat of honor. They want that most cherished thing. And they just want to make Jesus look bad. But what's happened is they've missed this incredible chance to minister to someone who is hurting. Physically hurting, emotionally hurting, spiritually hurting. Someone who is broken, someone who is an outcast,
Someone who is in need of love and hope. And they miss this opportunity because of their pride. Right? I love Proverbs 29:23 because it says, a person's pride will humble him, but a humble spirit will gain honor. Pride eventually leads to a humbling place, but I love this reversal here that we see God say, but a humble spirit will gain honor. You know, there's not a whole lot of people asking that question. How can I be more humble today? You know, that's not a common question that you see. I don't think I have ever read in a Dear Abby column or anything where someone wrote in and said, Abby, I am just the greatest person on the planet. Look at how awesome I am. But how can I be more humble? How can I do that, right? We're typically looking for how can I get ahead? How can I make more money? How can I do this? How can I do this? Sometimes it's just simply, how can I be noticed? I feel like I'm invisible and I feel like no one's there. I've never walked into a Barnes & Noble and seen a section there, how to be more humble, right? It's not the question that most people are asking. Yet the Bible speaks over and over and over again about the value of humility. Over and over and over again. And notice this, a humble spirit will gain honor. A person's pride will humble him, and that will happen eventually, but a humble spirit will gain honor. So I love that idea, that concept of the honor of humility, right? How humility causes someone to be honored. Notice these guys, these Pharisees are jockeying for position. They want the place of honor. God's word has promised that the humble spirit, you will gain that honor, and it's going to be something far sweeter and far greater than anything you've ever seen. So how do we get that honor of humility? And I think it truly begins with seeing myself as God sees me. See, we sometimes misunderstand humility. You know, we think humility is just a poor self-image, right? Or we think of humility as you're just a worthless wimp who's not willing to stand up for himself, right? Or we think that humility is something weak, or it's something different, right? But I think it's so important that we have an honest evaluation of who we are as the Bible describes us. We have to start with humility, with truly seeing myself as God sees me. And here's what you actually see. On one hand, I am a sinner that deserves death, and I deserve hell. And yet on the other hand, I am a child of God. I am a sinner, a worthless sinner. I am a child of God. Humility is found in that tension and the balance between those two realities. If I am a sinner and there's nothing good in me, and I am a child of God, humility is found in the tension between those two things. Are you with me on all this? Paul actually wrote in Romans 7 about how he's such a wretched creature who he can't refrain from doing the wrong things. He says, the wrong things that I don't want to do, I find myself doing those things. And the right things, those things that I really want to do, I don't ever seem to do those things. And he says, what a wretched man I am. That's how Paul describes himself in Romans chapter 7. He pictures, it's almost like this picture of failure, this picture of I just can't seem to do what it is I'm supposed to do. And I think every one of us in here has probably said that at one time or another. But then the very next chapter in Romans 8, Paul talks about how we are deeply loved as children of God, heirs of God with Jesus, with Christ. Was he confused? I mean, how can you have in Romans 7, you write about how you're just this wretched, horrible person who can't seem to do anything right. But then the very next chapter, you talk about how you're this honored child of God, getting to serve as a co-heir with Jesus. Was he confused? No, he understood that balance. That balance of seeing yourself the way that God sees you. Paul, Romans 7:18, he says, I know that nothing good lives in me. Romans 8:14, he said, those who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. And I love, humility makes us look at things through God's eyes. And I love the words of Jesus actually in John 15:5, where he says, without me, you can't do anything. Without me, you can do nothing. But yet you see Paul actually writing in Philippians 4 when he's talking about how life is just everything is bad and he doesn't know how he's going to get on. He goes, yet I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. Right? So even in those moments of everything seems to be going wrong and I don't know how I'm going to survive, Paul says, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. Why? Just like Jesus says in John chapter 15, without me, you can do nothing. Right? You with me on all that? One of my favorite writers is a guy named Tozer. Aidan Tozer, man, that guy, I can't stand him because he convicts me all the time with his writing, you know? You know those guys that you read his words and you go, oh, Tozer, come on. But they're so good. I love what Tozer said about humility. He said, a humble man is not a human mouse afflicted with a sense of his own inferiority. I love that, right? A humble man is not just a human mouse, a mouse walking around who's actually a human, but he's really just a mouse in human form. And he's inflicted with his own sense of his own inferiority because humility is not about your own inferiority at all. This is what Tozer says about it. He says, a humble man has accepted God's estimate of his own life. He knows that he is weak and helpless as God declared him to be. But paradoxically, he knows at the same time he is in the sight of God of more importance than the angels. And then Tozer says this, in himself, nothing, and God, everything. Well, that's what humility looks like. It's found in this tension, this balance between who we really are. Sinners who can do nothing wrong, but so loved from God who's adopted us and made us his children. And it's all about Jesus. And it's all about what he can do in your heart. And humility is setting aside that pride and go, it's not about me, but it's about Jesus in me. And in truth, I think that a lot of times, especially in this story with the Pharisees, I think you see this truth about humility as well, too. That true humility is revealed in how I treat others, right? Humility isn't some kind of a badge that you get to wear. You know, you don't get a little, you know, a little badge on your work ID that says, check, she's a humble person. People see that and go, oh, you're a humble person, right? You know, you have your driver's license that shows if you're an organ donor, you know. There's not a Christian card that has a little checkbox that says, oh, this is a humble person. Isn't that great, right? But humility is not a badge that we wear because it's pride that makes you want to have the best seats at the table. It's pride that makes you want to rush to the line to be in front of everyone else. Pride keeps that I at the center of the universe, right? Because that's what pride is about. It's about me. It's about I. It's about all of this that I am doing by myself. But humility is substituting the I with the words Jesus, right? Two of the greatest preachers in England that I loved in the 18th century were two guys. One guy you've probably heard of, John Wesley. You've heard of that guy? We sing his hymns to this day. Another guy isn't as well known, but he probably should be, George Whitefield, right? Now, George Whitefield and John Wesley in the 18th century had a very public argument that went on for years and years. I mean, it was the thing that everyone talked about, this big controversy between these two. Okay, so you've got on one side, you've got Whitefield, who's what's known as a Calvinist, right? You actually have on the other side John Wesley, who isn't a Calvinist, and we're not going to talk about Calvinism and deal a lot with all that kind of stuff. But y'all, this was a bitter, ugly argument between these two men. Okay, you go back and read, and it's one of these things. So one time in an interview, George Whitefield was being interviewed, and it's a public record that they disagree on all this. They're on different sides of this debate. So this newspaper reporter, who's wanting to help stir that up a little bit, he actually asked Whitefield, he asked him this question. I'm not making this up. He said, do you think you will see John Wesley in heaven, right? This reporter's going, all right, these guys have this very public spat. I'm going to ask him this question. Do you think that you will see John Wesley in heaven? George Whitefield said, I don't expect to see Mr. Wesley in heaven. The reporter is like going, woohoo, pay dirt. Gosh, think of the headlines. Oh, man, this is going to be the biggest story of my life. It's such a great thing. So I think he's just thinking that, man, he's just getting to fan the flames even higher. And then George Whitefield went on and he said, no, I want to quote him here. He said, no, I don't expect to see John Wesley in heaven because he is such a faithful servant of God that he will be so close to the throne of God and I will be so far away, I don't expect to see him. Right? That's humility, isn't it? These guys are having a very public debate. These guys that are on opposite sides of a theological issue, a Bible issue. These guys that publicly had been on huge at odds and argumentative about all of that. And George Whitefield, and all of the humility that he has, when he gets asked, you can see him in heaven, he goes, no, he's going to be so close to Jesus, I'm not even going to be able to see him, right? I'm going to need a telescope to be able to see where he is versus where I'm going to be. Y'all, do you understand what humility looks like? Humility is found in the way we treat others. And these Pharisees, the ones that had been arguing for this place of honor, the ones that their pride had been driving the show here, the ones that wanted to have this place of honor, missed out on the perfect chance to show what humility really looked like as this man with dropsy shows up. This man that has this physical ailment shows up. And the only person that shows humility in this situation is Jesus. Jesus who heals the guy. That's one of the most fascinating healings to me. Because this guy had a physical thing. I mean, his body is swollen. Now, there's probably some sort of liver issue or heart issue or kidney issue that's causing all of that. But Jesus understands what the issue is, and he heals that issue. And this guy's physical self actually changes in front of him as the water dissipates. You kind of catch that picture? I'm assuming that's what it looks like is when Jesus heals him and sends him on his way. And now these guys just want to argue about if Jesus broke the Sabbath or not. While this guy's entire life was just changed. This guy's entire existence was just changed. This guy just was shown love that he hasn't felt, and he's gotten hope, and he's gotten all these incredible things, and yet these prideful guys are sitting back there going, he can't do that. It's the Sabbath. Right? That's probably the way they talked. You know, that's how they talked about it. He can't do that. I don't know if that was the dog talking or old English. I have no idea. But you get the point here. Their own pride had him so wrapped up in the way they thought they understood the rules, and they cared more about the rules that they could control, the rules that they felt that they understood. They cared more about that than they did this hurting soul that was right in front of them. And Jesus, who cares far more about people than he cares about anything else, heals him. Jesus, the one who wrote those rules that have been so misunderstood by the Pharisees. Jesus, the one that put all of that in place, heals the guy. Doesn't say, come back in 4 hours and we'll do it then. Right? He doesn't say, well, I would, but it's not Monday, so it's not Sunday, it's Saturday. I can't do that for you, right? Jesus doesn't care about that. Because he understands the way Jesus describes it in Mark 2 is he says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And Jesus understands the heart of God in such a huge way. Y'all, I want you to understand, humility, it begins by seeing yourself the way that God sees you, but you actually can notice it in your life and how you treat others, specifically those that you have problems with. Right? And sometimes, I think this third thing we need to realize is that sometimes God strengthens that humility in some pretty painful ways, right? Oh man, this one hurts. This one hurts because I want us to understand that sometimes God's going to create a humility in you, whether you want it or not. He did with Paul. Look at what Paul actually wrote in 2 Corinthians 7, verses 6 through 10. Here's what Paul starts off saying. He says, if I want to boast, I wouldn't be a fool because I'd be telling the truth. Don't you love Paul? Paul is the only person that can say that. This is what he says in 2 Corinthians 7, 6. He says, if I wanted to boast, it wouldn't be an empty boast. I could boast and I could brag about who I am. He goes on and he says, but I will spare you so that no one can credit me with something beyond what he sees in me or hears in me, especially because of the extraordinary revelations. And notice what Paul says. Paul, the guy that just said, man, I could boast and talk about me and it wouldn't be this empty boast. But notice what he says in verse 7. He says, therefore, so that I would not exalt myself, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to torment me so that I would not exalt myself. You kind of catch that there? Paul goes, man, I could boast and it wouldn't be an empty boast.
But so that I wouldn't exalt myself, a thorn in the flesh was given to me to torment me, so that I would not exalt myself. And he goes on and he says that I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that he would leave me. But God responded with these words that you actually see over in verse 9. He says, my grace is sufficient in you, for my power is perfected in weakness. Isn't that amazing? Paul goes, man, it would be easy for me to exalt myself, so God humbled me by giving me this thorn in the flesh. And I begged God, God, would you please just take this from me? And God says, no, because my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is perfected in your weakness. And Paul goes on and he says, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may be in me, may reside in me. And you get to verse 10 and he says, so I take pleasure in weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and in difficulties for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Because Paul understands this tug of war, this tension between seeing yourself as that person that he says in Romans 7, just messes up all the time, but seeing yourself as this loved, cherished child of God. Y'all, pride drives our car way more than it should, way more than we think it should. And if I could just say it this way, these Pharisees, these people missed out on this incredible opportunity when this guy was hurting, and all they were concerned about were the things that they were concerned about, right? They weren't willing to let their agenda be sidetracked to help someone. They weren't willing to stop what it was they were doing. They thought that they were doing the most important thing. And I love the way that Charles Spurgeon talked about this in a sermon one time. He asked this question. He says, have I written in the snow? Isn't that a fascinating question? Have I written in the snow? Spurgeon said, will my life work endure the lapse of years and the fret of change? Has there been anything immortal in it which will survive the speedy wreck of all sublunary things? He says this. He says, the boys inscribe their names in capitals in the snow, and in the morning's thaw, the writing disappears. Right? Then Spurgeon asks this question. Will it be so with my work? Or will the characters which I have carved outlast the brazen tablets of history? Have I written in the snow? Now, you know what your pride does? It's writing in the snow. I remember being a kid and, you know, it would snow and you would write your name. You know, I would always write, David was here. It was like the greatest thing in the world, right? The next day it would be gone. Y'all, I want you to understand, everything your pride wants you to do is about writing in the snow. And it's going to be here today and it's going to look good and it's going to look awesome. But it will not stand the test of time. But humility and the actions that God causes you to do in humility, those will be honored someday, just like it says in Proverbs 29:23. Those are worthy of honor. It's not just riding in the snow. Now it's time for us to let humility be the thing that drives us. It's time for us to let humility be how we get our meaning, not our pride, not all the things that we can say we have done or all the things that we want to focus on. Instead, let's be humble enough to say, okay, God, I'm going to follow you. And when these ministry opportunities pop up, like Jesus had this man with dropsy, when a ministry opportunity pops up, take it. Doesn't matter if it interferes with your day. Doesn't matter if it interferes with your plan. It doesn't matter if it interferes with your pride, right? These Pharisees are like, oh, man, look at this guy. He doesn't belong here. He wasn't invited, right? Y'all, when a ministry opportunity pops up, take it, because that's humility in action. Let's pray. Father, we just thank you for how you work. We thank you for this incredible story. God, I truly believe we're going to see this person who suffered from dropsy up in heaven. And I hope that we see some of the Pharisees that were around this table up in heaven too. But Lord, just remind us of the importance of humility. Remind us of the importance of having the same attitude that you have. As we see in Philippians 2, the same attitude that Christ Jesus had, who's willing to set aside everything for us. Father, give us a good view of who we are.
Give us a good view of what humility really is, and then help that to trickle out in the way we treat others this week. Help that to trickle out in the way we view ministry this week. Help that to trickle out in the way we live our lives as we go to work or school tomorrow, or we go to Walmart, or we go wherever it is that we're going to be. Remind us of what humility is. Be with us, Father. And then use our lives and use our stories to further your kingdom this week. For it's in your name we pray. Amen.